Fifth-year radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.
The program, co-hosted by myself, Andre Lopez Turner, and Juan Toledo, in association with extraradio1.com and ztrradio.podomatic.com, welcomes Luis Eslava into the studio. He's a professor of international law and development at Kent University, Harvard University, and Melbourne University. We welcome Luis into the studio to talk about relatively easy things like colonialism, dependency, and international law. So three huge subjects: colonialism, dependency, and international law. Thank you very much, Luis, for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Much appreciated. Is there an order to colonialism, dependency, and international law? Are they interdependent?
What is the hierarchy?
Is there a hierarchy? Do we have one? Do we see one?
That's an excellent question. The thing is that there is not an evident order, but there are order in the terms of how, what they produce. And so there's a very good argument to say that the three main elements of our conversation today, colonialism, international law, and dependency, they are just discourses that are written by conflict, fluctuation, dynamic that we cannot determine, so on and so forth. But however, there's also a very good argument to say that whatever they do and whatever they behave on a daily basis, they ended up producing very identifiable outcomes, not only in one place, but all across the world. So, for example, just take the level of income distribution. And it is clear that over the last century or so, what we have produced as a planet is a very certain, clear pattern of income distribution in countries in the center, in the semi-periphery, and the periphery. And that clarity poses a massive intellectual challenge for those that believe that what is out there is all indeterminate.
If you talk about income inequality, and I mean, it's so pertinent to how we are now, but I was going to say, from my point of view, coming from a country which has been colonized, New Zealand, from the indigenous perspective, or the native people, some people say the first people in New Zealand were the Moriori, followed by the Maori. I mean, let's say the Maori and the indigenous people, colonized by English people, or actually the French for a while, and the Dutch, but mainly English. But anyway, from an indigenous point of view, or from being the colonized point of view, there is a lot of evidence to say that the income equality started from that moment on. Most people that are colonized usually end up being poorer and have harsher statistics in various realms of social depredation. But I guess what I'm trying to get to, maybe I'll be really crude here, the colonizers often go to these places to extract resources or to enforce a religion, or to explore, we could be generous, explore, or to have a dominance against another culture or empire. So I would say that not only breeds income inequality, but there's a dependency which is set, and there's a hegemony of law, because we have indigenous law, natural law, maybe spiritual law, but definitely indigenous and tribal laws of countries which are usually or almost always usurped by the colonizer. So if we're talking about international law, I don't know really where my question is going here, but it seems to be
the clashes between different laws.
Yeah, well, we don't have a Maori international law, we don't have a Quechua law, we don't have an Aymara law. You know, we have, in general, we are ruled these days and have been for a while by Anglo-Saxon American law. How do you feel about that? Where do you come from on that? You're a professor of this and a man from South America yourself?
I thank you for...
That's a big question.
No, thanks for challenging me on that. So I think what is behind all of that is a word that you didn't mention, which is imperialism. So imperialism nowadays is seen as a bad thing. So imperialism is everything that was regressive, everything that was past, everything that is pre-modern from our present. However, and when we go and study imperialism, imperialism was in many ways both a legal enterprise and it was a cultural enterprise. And the legal and the cultural enterprise went hand by hand. Why is this important? When the European colonizers, the European imperial messengers went out to the colonies, they went out not in a kind of unruled, totally disregarding norms enterprise kind of thing. They went out there with the law, and they went out there with the law and with a particular culture that legitimized their actions. When they hit ground in countries like New Zealand, but in countries like Australia, but also in all across Latin America before then, they go there with a very certain with an attitude that was underpinned by a sense of legality and legitimacy, and they got there also with a sense that that legality and that legitimacy was an expression of goodness. Therefore, the people that didn't abide to those laws and the people that didn't abide or didn't comply with the culture were somehow outcast, or they were somehow barbaric.
Morally inferior
and then had to be dominated. Now, this is interesting, again, because when we try to imagine today that encounter, that first encounter, we again imagine that encounters being kind of expressed in the form of certain kind of explicit depredation or total annihilation of everyone that was in front of the colonizer. But it was certainly a good chunk of that first encounter was about explicit violence, but perhaps the majority of that encounter was about bringing into the realm imperial law and imperial culture those subjects that were now subjects of empire. Yeah. And so a good chunk of imperialism was about indoctrination. We now will call, in a kind of critical way, indoctrination, but it was about bringing people into the realm of a particular kind of law, bringing people into a particular kind of jurisdiction. So when we think about that, we start imagining imperialism in a different way, and therefore analyzing imperialism in a different way.
I'm not going to defend colonialism, and I'm not going to defend the imposition of one culture or one set of laws on another one. But it is a much more complex process, isn't it? It's a kind of two-way process. It's no unilateral process, in the sense that when the supposed Spain as a colonial power of Latin America goes to Latin America, they discover the new world, the conscience of Europe also changes. The conscience of Europe is altered at the same time. So that you go, for example, in 1550, the Valladolid encounter between Gil Saavedra and Bartolomé Las Casas. And what is the discussions? Do the Indians have a soul? Mighty, mighty subject. Huge. And they decided that yes, the Indians have a soul. So by definition they could be Christianized. So there is also a process now of assimilation. That's what I'm getting at. And it's assimilation of the other. And then an assimilation that happens beyond the jurisdictions of law. And I'll give you another example. The sailors who stay behind when Columbus arrived to the Americas and they started to live with the Indians. And they taught Spanish to the Indians. Sailors who said, I don't want to go back. I don't have anything in Spain. I gotta stay here. I stay here having free love. Probably the first hippies ever in the history of humanity, if you think about it. Those sailors who stayed with the Indians, you know, at the beginning of the 16th century, 1500s. There you are. So there is a process of learning from the other and having to assimilate the other. The Spanish crowns, for all the shortcomings, all the exploitations, they were concerned about the welfare of the Indians. They were. In a misguided way, you might say, with the benefit of hindsight, now we said, okay, there was exploitations. And then slavery, Borges says about this, started as an act of philanthropy. With Bartolomé Las Casas saying, look, the Indians cannot resist the exploitations of gold and silver mines. Why don't we bring a much stronger race, the black race? So you got these elements. What I'm trying to say is that it is not a simple one-way thing.
Yeah, I mean...
I think
yeah, if we try and bring always balance to stuff, when you think about colonialism can be a dirty word, and you know, I was reminded when I was in South America a long time ago, my father actually sent me an article saying, and I think it was entitled Romancing the Indigenous. So, you know, it was kind of like trying to say I talk in the New Zealand context to a certain extent, like or, you know, the English people who call you or have called me and us things like subjects and things, and they talk about us being civilized or civilized, you know, which is a very loaded word. I always see that as very, it's, you know, degrading. But certain tribal indigenous cultures, if we look upon them in the current context, a lot of people would be horrified, you know, like women are not allowed to participate in certain political gatherings, not allowed to speak in certain tribes in New Zealand, on a marae, others, etc., yes and no. So I think that's a fair point to talk about a slight balance. But the counter to that is, I will put myself a little bit out here to a certain point, but I used to regularly heard the wonderful Christopher Hitchens once talk, Hay on Wye Festival, and he was great. And then he sort of slurred into cannibalism, and he mentioned, you know, primitive people and uncivilized behavior. Now, from where I come from, what I understand about Maori culture, I've always defended cannibalism, which is very, very controversial, because I think the white imperial view is very ignorant of the spiritual background of cannibalism, which was, I defeat you, Juan, your tribe, your amazing people, and we happen to eat some of you, and we're taking your spirit and your essence and your power and your prestige and all these things, and we're eating them, imbibing them.
Well, as a way of colonizing, a way of colonizing.
But it's also a great mark of respect and other kinds of... See, that's not... They're uncivilized. I'm trying to make a point here. Like,
absolutely.
Who dictates the law? Who says what law is good, and who says what is civilized and what isn't? And you know, and then my last question, maybe to bring it in, if we talk about international law and where we are now, it's international. We've sort of evolved to some extent in lots of areas, and we're looking at maybe a international benchmark where we all agree that on certain fundamentals.
Yeah, so thank you. So I think what we're here talking about the complexity of the colonial encounter and the limitations of thinking that the colonial encounter was all about oblivion and it was about totally black slate. We annihilate and we get rid of it all indigenous, and we just started with a new law, the imperial law, bring it on. But clearly it was not that. It was a very messy process, and it has a very messy process over the last, just to take the European colonial recent colonial venture, the last 500 years. And it has, as time has passed, and every minute, the life experience of colonialism is one that is extremely diverse. There's just no question about that. And the record, when we look at the particularities of each instance and we try to contextualize each instance, are extremely diverse. However, and this is however is extremely important, when we look at the historical record and what the historical record has produced, is a very clear pattern of dispossession that we cannot excuse as a result of that problematization. Okay, so even though, for example, we say that the colonial counter has cross-pollinated both sides of the equation, it is very clear who has lost as a result of this game. It is so much so that we have examples, current examples, in which countries that portray themselves as being at the forefront of civilization in the 21st century, for example, Australia, with one of the highest human development indexes, one of the highest income per capita, one of the highest levels of education, is still claims to be so developed, while at the same time, it keeps within its boundary the oldest civilization in history, totally impoverished and largely living in jails. So, and it is here law comes into place. That context is legitimate, and it's legitimate according to state law. A particular kind of law that cannot listen properly, indigenous or in this case Aboriginal law, just to follow the Australian example. So, the problematization that I'm putting on the table is exactly the problematization that critical international legal scholars we have been advancing over the last 20 years or so. Basically, the point that we have been trying to advance in brief is that international law, when we talk about international law, it is impossible to talk about it away from the long colonial history that has brought together the world in which we live in. And two, we cannot think about international law away from what it does on a daily basis at the domestic level. Okay? So basically how colonialism, as it was one emerge around the 16th century and it expanded, today has created the law, the international law that we live in, and how that law, that post-colonial law that can ever be post-colonial truly, affects domestic legal relations.
Yeah. How does that argument, well, I don't think it's an argument, I think it's a statement of fact that you just presented to us, how does that go down in, when you're in Australia at the University of Melbourne? Is it, because as a New Zealander, I don't want to get too much into the conflict because I do think we're considerably further afield in advance now. But how does that travel?
It is again a wonderful question. And I think just to say something about what you say last, and definitely New Zealand is way ahead, because the colonial encounter was shaped very differently. So the treaty making processes that took place as the colonial encounter started has shaped the history of New Zealand profoundly, which was not replicated in the case of Australia. There was no treaty making process at that point, and the situation of the Aboriginal communities across Australia is shaped because of that reason. Now, how it travels? It travels as political discussions travels. It is received well in some spaces and it's not received well in other spaces. And I think Australia, like many other countries in the world today, is a bicephalous kind of country. You know, there's a part of Australia that is extremely progressive, and it's also another part of Australia that is not progressive. And the conversation today, as we speak, as the Prime Minister has recently changed, he demonstrates once again that Australia has had the ability a few years ago to realize that he had a very important section of the population that had to be respected, that the law had to be respected. But at the same time, you have other sections of the population that are regressive and they don't want to buy that story. And there's a political battle, and a very important political battle.
A couple of observations and a question. Observation number one about colonialism. Any form of colonialism is cannibalistic. I'll give you an example. Metaphysical cannibalism. It just occurred to me, that concept. Metaphysical cannibalism. The Romans, whenever they conquered other territories, they used to take their gods away and take them to Rome. In the Roman times, you have a god for cooking, a god for taking a bath, a god for drinking wine, a god for making love, a god for going out for a walk. And this plethora of gods came from the fact that they were taking other territories, all these gods. So there wasn't cannibalism. Any form of appropriation implies cannibalism. Christianity cannibalized pagan culture in order to impose Christianity. Christmas, etc., etc. Point number one. Point number two, what Louis was referring to, the experience of the colonization. And I was thinking about Australia and the United States. Two forms of colonization which are very different from the ones, for example, in Africa or in Latin America. The Spaniards and the Europeans, particularly the French and the English, and to a certain extent the Belgians in Congo, and the experience of colonization in those parts. In America, in Australia, were colonizations of annihilation. There was Protestant, Presbyterian, Calvinistic colonization of the 17th century America going by the white race. And the frontier was basically moving that white race and eliminating the natives. The few natives that now exist are almost, well, culturally now they are given pieces of land for them to build casinos. That's what's happening in America nowadays. But it's almost non-existent. It's basically white, Presbyterian, Calvinistic, something that also happened in Australia. So the reality of colonialism is different. In Latin America, it's different. It's obviously hideous, but there's any elements. But the third point is this. Any law, any international law, has to do with that experience of colonization. Is the state and whatever that tries to impose there. In America was the American Constitution, for example. It's the only constitution that talk about the right to be happy. And the free spirit, and the Second Amendment, the freedom to carry guns and stuff. So colonization implies the law. And the expansion of that law implies with how successful that colonization has been for the rest of the world. But the question to Luis is this. We keep living, re-experience those elements of colonization. Now we talk about neocolonialism, or we might talk about neo-neocolonialism. Is this a continuous narrative?
Yeah. So there was Michel Foucault, the famous French philosopher, once said that we carry the traces of history. So we are an archive, and one, especially if you come from the South, you're certainly an archive of imperialism. And you are an archive of the different mutations of imperialism, and it has first emerged and it has evolved from over the last several centuries. So yes, once upon a time, imperialism was about destruction and total absorption of whatever it was in front of it. Then it was a settler colonialism that it was experienced in Australia and New Zealand. Then it was quite rapacious, racialized imperialism, and it was experienced in Africa. Then was experienced, and we're experiencing it still now, as neo-colonialism. And we live through all of that. And what is more interesting is perhaps is that we are colonized on a daily basis, again by the same history. So colonialism colonizes what is already colonized. Now,
a brilliant tautology.
What is interesting here, and just to go back to your first point, is the cannibalism of it. You call it metaphysical cannibalism, but which is really interesting because very famous, again another famous character, Eduardo Vivero de Castro, the anthropologist from Brazil, he calls it cannibal metaphysics. And what he calls cannibal metaphysics, what he tries to invite us is to think about that there are different ways of engaging with the world. And he calls it the school that he belongs to, and he has been able to contribute with the course of his work, is idea that there is, it's important to understand the perspectives. They call it perspectivism. And there are different ways in which you can engage the world depending on where you stand. And in his work with Amazonian communities, he has been able to show how cannibalism and the kind of experience of not necessarily explicit cannibalism, but the experience that they have with the world out there assigns ontological being in the world a category of being to things that we, from a Western point of view, don't assign agency. And what I'm saying this is because this thing that we have been talking here and referring to as imperialism, it comes with not simply a particular form of extracting resources and accumulating resources, but it comes with it with a particular form of understanding the world. It is one perspective amongst maybe possible many perspectives. So as we have moved on, as we have experienced multiple forms of imperialism, sadly, we have only ended up with one form of understanding the world. And there are multiple forms of understanding the world that it's important to remind us that exist there. Otherwise, we just get caught up in the discussion that the imperialism is multiple, maybe exists, maybe doesn't exist. But in fact, our brains are increasingly narrowed.
I'm leaping on the word cosmological because maybe we can shift this to the economic realm and the nature realm and international law and colonialism and dependency. And I was just because the cosmological thing is very interesting, because you could say, well, you know, I'll put something out there because it's little known. But the New Zealand Māori people have, in the Treaty of Waitangi, which was signed between the British and the Māori, basically the second clause is the biggest one. It says, Kawanatanga, Rangatiratanga, which is chieftainship and sovereignty, and Teonga are yours. And if you want to sell them, you have them, you have to sell them to us. We're called the Crown, right? But just getting on, otherwise we'll go all over the place here, but Teonga is anything which is spiritual, anything which is material or immaterial. So it's bringing in the cosmological and the nature. And in further settlement claims, further on from this, yeah. Some tribes would claim radio airwaves under the concept of Teonga. But just put that, because what I think, Luis, you're angling towards is the new colonialism, to a point, is about money and economics.
Flux of capital.
Yeah, and for a better word, we kind of live in a world, I call it Americana, an Anglo-American capitalism, which is very different to some of the colonialism that we've been talking about up to now. And if you talk about international law, laws about regulations and protections and rights and obligations and these kind of things and a lot more, but do you see the link here? Do you think the Anglo-American neo-colonialism, economic colonialism, it's effectively a new form of colonialism? Because I'll just end it here. You know, what struck me recently, and Luis, you will be very familiar with this, partly coming from the Commonwealth, is the Commonwealth for a while recently had a debate about whether they were going to have, possibly, the Queen as a head of state.
Yeah.
So they had a big meeting over here in London not too long ago. Commonwealth heads of state. But we were talking prior to this about democracy. It would have to be the most undemocratic thing ever. It was basically the Queen, as far as I can see, and this is a crude observation, handed it over to Charles. And everyone said yes, and the game goes on. So the colonialism in the Commonwealth, Brexit, coming out of Brexit, you know, we know what we're going into Africa, Commonwealth. Colonialism, that was so overt, wasn't it?
Yeah.
There's 52 heads of state. There was no democratic vote about this. It was just decided. But anyway, a few questions here. Economic colonialism and
cultural colonialism, perhaps.
Yeah, and international law. Because it seems to me, if you're not a member of the market, and I remember being in Peru, I think, or Bolivia, and hearing an indigenous guy saying, well, if you're not in the market, you're the forgotten people again. Which is this economic colonialism international law? If you're not a necessary economic subject, where are we? I mean, there's a lot there, I know.
Yes, a lot there. But one thing that I will say is that, and to try to tie things together, is the way in which those, what we are witnessing today, competing claims of legitimacy that attend to competing ways of capital accumulation. So when the Commonwealth even attempts to think that it is a good idea to declare the Queen once again the ruler of the Commonwealth, basically what we are witnessing is a really serious case of anachronism. Anachronism in the sense of trying to once again bring to power a figure that ensured once upon a time capital accumulation, which is no longer possible. Okay, so it is a kind of a romantic, nostalgic, suicidal, anachronistic impulse behind it, by a particular kind of elite that believe that that's the way to create order in the world. While at the same time, the same world, our world, is being ruled by figures, interest, forces that do not have anything to do with the Queen. And
Queen care less about her.
Exactly. And when they care about
corporations,
they care about her, care insofar as the Queen governs territories and ensures an instability that benefits the reproduction of capital. Why is all of this interesting? Because first, we live in a world that is full of contradictions. Yeah, so a world that on the one hand tries to return to the Queen, while at the same time it is ruled by financiers and people that today accumulate more wealth than have ever accumulated in the history of humankind. But it's also a world that, even though it is existing those contradictions, those contradictions continue to neglect is the possibility of leaving the world otherwise. And that otherwiseness is really important when we think about who is left behind, who is not taken into account. And we think about that section, which is not a small section, is the majority of the world population that is being constantly left aside. We realize the viciousness of that contradiction. And that's extremely important. That's extremely important. Now, what is that new coming from an international lawyer, from someone that works in as a teacher of international law? It is because, in a sort of way, many of those contradictions that I was mentioning before are sponsored by law. They are legitimate enterprises. Okay, they're bringing in the Queen back again into the realm of government, proper functional government, no symbolic government. And the fact that we live in a world in which the 8 richest people accumulate more wealth than the 50% of the global population, they are both absolutely legitimate enterprises. Once you put that on the table, the conversation becomes very differently, because there is a sense out there that maybe if we are clever enough, maybe we mobilize the right law, everything will be sorted. And the fact is that's not possible. There is no a law that is going to trump over all of the contradictions in the world. Law sustains the contradictions. And this is important coming from an international lawyer, and from someone that teaches international law, because we need to understand that in order to start making that particular kind of world order.
huge world contradiction, and you have to read Marx's Communist Manifesto to realize that the engine of capitalism is these contradictions, and is the incorporation of those contradictions. I'll give you my own genealogy of capitalism and its liberating forces and at the same time its contradictory forces. If you think in the history of the last 200 years, 250 years, we call a history of the inclusion of the other. You were talking about the otherness. We start with children and start with the romantics. The reinvention of childhood started with childhood. And then you got people like William Blake in books like Songs of Innocence and Experience. And then you got Charles Dickens. If you got the whole literature of Charles Dickens, it's about the child, which not many children. We children, orphan children left out by society, but recovered by philanthropists. So the child and the invention of Christmas, the invention of Christmas in the 19th century. And Dickens was big, big, big figure about establishing Christmas as a celebration, as a national, now international, now global celebration. Then what do we have? Women, particularly during the war. The war forced women to go out and to be part of the bellic industries to produce something. Once you got them, metaphorically speaking, once you got them out of the house, there was no way you were going to get them back. What did you have after the Second World War? The ethnic diverse. Why? Europe need the diverse from the colonies, particularly Britain and Europe, bring the colonies to help with the reconstruction, with the Marshall Plan, paid by the United States of Europe. What happened after the ethnic diverse? Gay people. Homosexuality became legal in 1967. Why homosexuality was illegal? Because it did not reproduce the family. Plato talks about homosexuality, there's no problem, but there was no capitalist concept during the in traditional Hellenistic cultures. But yeah, when if it doesn't reproduce the family, it's condemnatory. It doesn't reproduce the taxpayer, the producer. What happened after the gay? The disabled people become part of the engine of production. Now we are moving into animals, and soon in the future we will move into plants. Everything has been a process of integration. Now, capitalism liberates these people, liberates the forces of, for example, youth. Imagine, the youth culture was created by the Americans after the Second World War. In the 1950s, you start to have music specifically targeted for young people. Elvis Presley and rock and roll, a commodity that young people would consume. That commodity metamorphosed itself into a hippie movement, into a civil rights movement, so liberated some forms that at the same time became critical of capitalism. But capitalism uses them. You become critical of capitalism, capitalism absorbs that criticism and then sells it back to you. The punk movement is the perfect example. You are anti-establishment. But if you are a punk, you have to buy punk music, go to punk clubs, or you had to in the late 1970s, and consume punk culture that costed money. So capitalism liberates you in order to generate source ways to consume. And now everything is so specific, isn't it? The capitalism has created these niche markets that liberates.
Inclusivity,
but at the same time, inclusivity in order to create a market. It liberates a conscience, but it makes it productive for capitalism itself. The final thing, and the biggest contradiction, British Petroleum becoming ecologically conscious.
Yeah. Well,
there you are.
So, yeah, that's a very good point. And then I think I just want to talk about a dependency for a minute.
Okay.
So, because it's basically, that was the problem that they tried to wrestle with. So, dependency, los dependentistas, o la escuela de la dependencia, the dependency theorists, was a group of most of them economists in Latin America that tried to wrestle with the fact that even after formal independence, even after a century and sometimes a century and a half of formal independence, these countries in Latin America were still totally conditioned by the economies of the center. They continue to produce primary commodities. They continue to import capital goods, which means import sewing machines in order to do the shoes that now were produced nationally. But because you were importing the sewing machine, you had to pay more of a larger percentage of what you were gaining nationally. Therefore, you were accumulating debt constantly so on and so forth. And what the conclusion that they arrive is that the world system that these people were trapped were a world system marked by dependency, marked by the fact that even though you wanted to develop and to come out of the underdevelopment that you that was your starting point, you were always going to be dependent on the formal economies. And now this is important for what you were saying before, we were discussing before, is that in the process of agglutinating, bringing new beings into the global economy, you not only bring them as full subjects, but you bring them as dependent subjects. And that's really crucial, because you become, for example, increasingly a modern subject. For example, you like rock. And in order to like rock, you need to buy the music that comes from particular channels, which takes your money away from your realm of sovereign power to somewhere else. And just to say the importance of dependency theories to think about the present moment. However, and this is an additional and last point, even though capitalism is always about incorporation, and it is impossible to think beyond that, or to just not, or impossible to not think about that, to just to express myself better, it is always important to remember that capitalism is always a contradictory process. And capitalism brings people into processes of economic production and accumulation, but those people have somehow, at some point, an agentic power. They say something, they think something, and they are not totally obnubilated by that process. Yeah. So there's a famous post-colonial historian called Dipesh Chakrabarty, and he a few years ago he wrote a book called Provincializing Europe, and then he uses in that book a very simple artifact, but a very powerful historiographical artifact, which is basically composed of two elements. And he said history, universal history, the history that here we're talking about, the history of the expansion of capital and the bringing into the realm of capital everyone that crosses its path, from peasants to people living with disabilities, it is always has two faces. There's a history one, there's a history two. History one is the history of everything that is subservient to capital, everything that works for capital. But at the same time, there's a history that doesn't work to capital. It's an element of history that fight back. It's an element of history that say, I don't want to play your game. And this is rock, for example, the history of music is a very good example of that. Okay? It was definitely produced by the American cultural machine. And it piggybacked on the military industry of America. It expanded through the same channels of the expansion of American financial capital, but at the same time, totally and absolutely changed the map of how we experience life.
Yeah, creating a counterculture.
I created a counterculture. I'm not here advocating necessarily that revolution is going to come out of rock and roll.
Yeah.
Didn't come out of that. And it won't. But it definitely checked the foundations of how capital function, and capital had to readapt to it,
and it did.
Interesting.
Another thing.
I mean, we're all going so many different tangents.
Yes.
Fascinating. I just want to say on dependency, what do you make of Bolivia under Evo Morales? Because I remember when he first came into power, he toured the world, and he said basically to imperial colonial countries with corporations that have been resource suckers out of the Bolivia, he said there's some kind of phrase in Bolivia which is Bolivia is a golden chair and we're the beggars that sit underneath it, something like that. And Morales said, more or less, he said, the contracts have been 80-20. You get 80, we get 20. And I'm giving you, mining resource companies, I'm giving you a year to decide whether you would accept the new contract, which is 80-20. So a reverse of a dependency, etc. I mean, I was quite chuffed by all of that. But this concept of dependency and international laws, do you think things are changing for the better on that? Trading blocks like Mercosur, I mean, the European Union is a trading bloc, and then you got free trade, global trade. How do you see the dependency
by Trump?
Because it's kind of, there's a reversion back to maybe if you go nationalism or protectionism is a form of regenerating from within, and I actually quite like it.
Yeah, no, and I think many people in the world I will join ranks there. We like that. We like the idea of the possibility of countries to sort out the economies. We like the idea of countries using the only resource that they have, that is the internal market. The only people that like choose producing Colombia, maybe are Colombians and not even Colombians, but they have to be forced to like them in order to create a market for those shoes, which will maybe perhaps create a middle class, which was maybe similar to the middle class that was at some point created during the 1960s and 1970s as a result of import industrialization strategies. Okay, now that's all good, and it's so good that even the IMF today says that it is important to try to achieve some level of reindustrialization of the economies of the world. And it's so good that even the IMF is saying that the current levels of global income inequality are damaging the expansion of capitalism. However, what is really interesting here is that even though the IMF doesn't like it, it cannot dominate it. Something has happened at the macro level that has changed the terms and conditions of how we experience the world and how the economy is working. So much so that even when we tend to think that China, for example, has disrupted the history of American economic power, hegemony, it is not true, actually. So current structural economists say China is a very good example of lifting people out of poverty through internal industrialization, but that doesn't have to do anything with the current capacity and power of the United States. And here, just to put another fact on the table, that power that we call American power is not even American power.
Anymore.
So, and again, so much so that we are now witnessing a maniac, Trump, that is trying to harness and trying to control that thing called financial capital.
Or going back, in certain ways, going back to a world that no longer exists. And it is like the end of an empire.
He's trying to do is to nationalize that financial power, or to bring that financial power under the authority of the state, but he is not proving very effective to do that.
Yeah, but he cannot do it. I mean, you're talking about the possibility of countries being isolated, isolationism, what is it called, in economic terms. So the idea of re-energizing economies from within. But now we are so linked globally that it's very, very difficult to do. I'll tell you what, it might be interesting. The ending of the dependency might be the kind of rebalancing the priorities of the world. In other words, raw materials like food, stuff essential for our survival, becoming more important than high technology. So if we start to rebalance that, there will be a rebalance of no dependency anymore. So countries that produce national products, Africa, Latin America, or those countries, might become much more kind of central to the narrative of power and the narrative of the future of the economies. And ecology will have a lot to say. You were talking about China. The limitation of capitalism on two accounts. Ecology, to start with, and the limitations about who benefits from this capital. What we see nowadays is these populist narratives coming from within countries like Britain, Europe, Western Europe, and the United States, of impoverished middle class and working class of those countries who have not benefited from the global capital. We in London, we feel London is fantastic. It's a global city. But go to Lincolnshire, Oxfordshire, go to the counties in England where there's no jobs. And they do not believe in the globalization. So there's this...
Well...
There's the narratives, yeah. The internal narratives of those countries at the same time.
Because I'm just leaping on your cannibalistic word before, which is... If you cannibalize globally and you extract resources and you privatize everything globally, which is that the system is, there's nothing left. So therefore we do have to go back to the other system and regenerate again. You know, the factories of the North are gone. Yeah, on that one. I mean, we're running out of time. There's so much to talk about. Just briefly, international law, the Iraq war, more or less illegal.
Yemen,
United Nations. A lot of stuff goes on. The United Nations, the hegemonic powers that be, disrespect international law. Must be quite frustrating being a professional professor of international law.
Oh my God, I can imagine. Yeah,
and the International Criminal Court. Oh. You know, certain people are not members of it.
Mm.
Are we right to think that? I mean, it's a great thing, international law, but if you're not from certain countries, how do we feel about that? How do people in the trade feel about that? Professors like yourself?
I think that's a very very good point, and I think it's extremely frustrating for those that believe in international law and believe in a particular kind of international law that prides itself to be. Not contaminated by imperialism or international law, then it is not contaminated by the history of capital, or is an international law that is goody-goody, that doesn't have to do anything with racism or sexism or all the rest of isms. But it's actually quite fascinating when you are critical of international law and you try to understand the machine and you try to do things with the machine. And I think that's my entry point to the conversation. I'm a critical international lawyer, not necessarily because I'm critical a priori. I'm critical because I come from a country that has been at the losing end of this game for a long time, and in particular, and I feel strong about a particular subsection of the population in that country that has been at the losing end of national elites that have piggyback on a particular kind of international law that I don't like. So, coming from that point of view, international law is extremely exciting. It is a field where that presents itself as being on the side of good and God, mm-hmm. but really, again and again, frustrates and undermines and curtails the aspirations of people, and that calls to kind of constant cross-examination and a concerted effort to try to do something different.
And last question from me, Luis. Do you think that international law is an unfulfilled wish that tries to move away from capital colonialism but fails to do so because of the realities of the market and realities of capitalism, but remains this idea, pure utopian almost, of internationalism and, you know, equality around the world?
I think it's a human enterprise. It's a human enterprise. As a human enterprise, it has a massive degree of utopianism and a massive degree of aspirations in it, but it's also is more than that. And here, being critical is important because it is more than that in the sense that actually materializes inequalities. It actually exploits people. It actually destroys the environment. So then, international law is a quite a complex creature. It is a creature that has lots of aspirations, that is a human enterprise, that have lots of faults, but at the same time, it goes out there and does something quite concrete. So it requires as a critical, a massive degree of imagination in order to come up with something different, but also a huge amount of political will to stand there and say, hang on, even though you are a human enterprise, you're doing something that I don't like in front of me.
We're going to have to wrap it up, but we did discuss, and maybe we can do it again some other time, also how Twitter influences a lot of our international relations and that, which was a fascinating conversation. But I know that Juan tells me you're a man of many facets, but people can see you in heavy Twitter dialogue yourself. So.
You got a blog, Luis, don't you? What is your blog?
Ken Law School at the University of Ken. I co-direct the Center for Critical International Law.
Okay.
And then we have a website and we contribute to our...
Can you tell us what the website is? Although we put it on the link when we publish, we podcast this program. What is their website?
So the blog of my law school is Countercurrents.
Okay.
So on behalf of Juan and myself and xradio1.com and ztrradio.podomatic.com, we'd like to very much thank you, Luis Slava, for coming in and delighting us with your superb knowledge.
ZTR Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.